When General Douglas MacArthur was fired from being over the Korean campaign in 1951 by President Truman, and with the accent of the chiefs of staffs and the Department of Defense people and General Bradley and many others, he came back and he was given a great ticker tape reception in New York, as nobody ever saw before. He was a great hero. And he came and gave a speech to the Congress of the United States. I think some of you who are older know about that, 1951. And it was quite a moving speech that he gave. It's called his farewell address. And I'd like to quote a little bit from it, because it's kind of interesting compared to talking about the things we're talking about today in the Feast of Trumpets. He said towards the end of his speech, "I know war as few other men now living know it, and nothing to me is more revolting. I have long advocated its complete abolition, as its very destructiveness on both friend and foe has rendered it useless as a means of settling international disputes. Indeed, on the second day of September 1945, just following the surrender of the Japanese nation on the battleship Missouri, I formally cautioned as follows. Men since the beginning of time have sought peace. Various methods through the ages have been attempted to devise an international process to prevent or settle disputes between nations. From the very start, workable methods were found in so far as individual citizens were concerned, but the mechanics of an instrumentality of larger international scope has never been successful. Military alliances, balances of power, leagues of nations, all in turn failed, leaving the only path to be by the way of the crucible of war. The utter destructiveness of war now blocks out this alternative. We have had our last chance. If we will not devise some greater and more equitable system, Armageddon is at our door. The problem basically is theological and involves a spiritual recrudescence and improvement of human character that will synchronize with our almost matchless advances in science, art, literature, and all material and cultural developments of the past 2,000 years. It must be of the spirit if we are to save the flesh. A very moving speech. It wasn't the end of it. He later said famously, "I'm just an old soldier, and old soldiers never die. They just fade away." An old song that they sang in West Point when he was there years before. Now, people are confused and usually wrong when they talk about Armageddon. I've seen different Bible dictionaries and so forth where it's said that most people believe that's where the end of the world is going to take place and the destruction of mankind is going to culminate in Armageddon. Well, a lot of people just think that way because they've just taken that one place in Revelation and taken that as that's all there is about it. There's a lot about Megiddo in the Old Testament, but not in that way. And so they think, well, that must be the place, because there's been a lot of wars taking place right there at that same place over the centuries. The earliest one they know of was the Pharaoh of Egypt in 1487 came up and fought the Canaanites there and beat them. And actually, Megiddo is quite an interesting place. That's the real name for it, armed. Megiddo is interesting because it's not that way in the Hebrew. It's Har-Mageddon, H-A-R, Megiddo. And Har, it means mound or mountain, or in this case, a tail, because Megiddo is a mound or a tail, T-E-L. I'm going to tell you all about it. But it's a culmination of many different towns that have been there for, been there and destroyed, and then, or flattened, and then another city is made on top of that. And that's why this tail is higher than the regular land all around it. 26 different layers of civilization are in that mound. And so it's rather interesting. But when we look at it, is this actually going to be the place where man is doomed and going to come to destruction and be finished? Actually, when you look at it, you find the context of the Bible on the subject of Megiddo or Armageddon. It actually shows that God has taken a hand to save mankind with this situation, this place. So I'd like to discuss today a little bit about Armageddon in the light of what the Bible says about it and what it leads to. So we can have the right understanding about it, because it's quite interesting. It's located about 70 miles, give or take a few miles, depends which way you come from there, north of Jerusalem. It's up in the lower Galilee area. It used to be part of Manasseh, the tribe of Manasseh, and close by were three different tribes of also Zebulun, Issachar, and Naphtali. And it's quite an interesting place. All around this mound called Megiddo, which means mound of, or mountain of the governor, that's what Megiddo means, governor. It's quite interesting. It's located in a place called Jezreel. In Jezreel, anybody's been to Israel and gone up there to see that area, you find it's a very beautiful area. Jezreel is called a valley, but that's because there's mountains to the west and to the east. They aren't really mountains because they aren't that high. They're more like hills. But there's Mount Tabor to the east, and then there's Mount Gilboa down to the southeast. And there's a Carmel Mountains to the west that goes to the coast. And it's interesting about this area because it's in a flat area. The plain of Jezreel is almost flat as a pancake. And it's rather interesting that they have farms there today. Israel has a lot of productive farms there. They raise corn and wheat and sunflowers. And they have pastures for animals. And it has a good rainfall. It has a rainfall comparable to Jerusalem, about 25 to 30 inches a year. It has a brook of Kishon that overflows with water when it rains in the winter. Sometimes it becomes like a flood, actually, and muddies the whole plain, which ran into a problem for one of God's enemies at one time, and we can tell you about that as it goes on. But it's a place where it was a junction for other countries to do trade, a trade route with the north up in Mesopotamia, up in Assyria, Babylon, Syria, and then you could go from there to the coast easily through a pass that went to the coast, the Way of the Sea it was called. And that would go all the way down into Egypt, right along the coast. And so it was quite important place where armies could readily negotiate if they wanted to get from one place to another fairly quickly. They didn't have to go through some rugged mountains to get there. The pass from Carmel, which is on the west coast of the country, almost to the Mediterranean, there was a pass that went to the east, and it ended up in Megiddo. And it went out into the Jezreel Plain. And then you could take that and go up north to Assyria and Babylon and so forth. And it's a regular trade route. And then if you wanted to go from there down to Jerusalem, you could go in three different ways. the way of the sea, as I mentioned before. That's the way the Assyrians came down. Sennacherib came down with his armies, the way of the sea, went through Megiddo to get there. And they came down to the south, and then they moved a little bit south of Jerusalem in the west, and then they came back to the north and struck Jerusalem from there, or in that siege. Then there's another way. It's called the Way of the Kings. And that comes down the east side of the country, down the Rift Valley by the Jordan. And that comes from Megiddo, and it goes down to Jerusalem also. And there's a third way. It's right down the middle of the country, right from Megiddo, straight down through the hills of Ephraim, just south of Manasseh, and it comes down into the hills of Judah, and it goes into Jerusalem. So there's three major ways anciently to get to Jerusalem from Megiddo. Megiddo was a great place to get from one place to another. It's like a superhighway and a junction. And you have to pretty well go through there if you want to get to another country, north or south, with any dispatch, with the least amount of trouble and problems. Now, it's rather interesting. You look in the Bible, you find all kinds of things happen in Megiddo. Remember Deborah and Barak in the book of Judges, for instance, and the famous Song of Deborah. Well, that was quite a story. And if you want to read the story in maybe easier form, I like the Bible Story for Children that Basil Wolverton did years ago. Volume 3 has that, a story about Deborah and Barak and Megiddo and what they ran into. And that's quite an interesting story because it turned out the Canaanites were up there and they wouldn't leave. They were in many different battles with Israel, but they'd never leave. The Israelites didn't do right. They did not kill them all like they should have done. That was one of the seven tribes they're supposed to completely annihilate so they wouldn't have trouble with them later, a thorn in their side. The Canaanites weren't nice people. To give you an idea, when they're building their house, if they had a little baby that was just born, an infant, then they would murder their child and put the baby down in the foundation of the house. And that was supposed to bless their house from the gods or something to protect it. I don't know what their idea was, but it certainly was horrible. That's one of the things they would do in their religious practices. Can you think of anything worse? And God wanted to get rid of them, plus the other six tribes that were there in Israel. Well, anyway, the Canaanites came back, you find, many different times and opposed Israel in fights. In the time of David, they came out. And David destroyed about all of them except 400 men who got away on horses one time. And then they came back later and they caused more trouble. But it's rather interesting. The Canaanites lived there and they lived in some of the best part of the country. For productivity and everything. Well, Barak and Deborah were told by God how to set up the battle. He says, you go over there to Mount Tabor, which is on the east side of the valley there, and you get 10,000 men. God told him how many to get. And he says, you put them up there from the tribes of Issachar and Naphtali. And Naphtali and Issachar were next to each other, close by. And it's interesting that these people were pretty good fighters, and they still are today. If we equate to what we think where Naphtali basically is, and also Issachar, we come out with Sweden and Finland. Sweden and Finland fighters have been notorious for being excellent people in battle. I remember the Finns showed up the Russians in 1940 for a while. And also the Swedes took over half of Russia one time from Peter the Great. So they were able to do that. But that wasn't all. God had them get 10,000 together. And then, of course, remember Barak was a little timid to go, and he said, "Well, I'll go." God told him to go with the fighters, and he said, "Well, Deborah, if you go with me, I'll go." And Deborah was she wasn't a judge necessarily. She was judging Israel in a way, but she's a very wise person, and she had a lot of capabilities, kind of like Golda Meir maybe later on. And so they did what God said, and they defeated the Canaanites. The Canaanites had these 900 chariots, and it's believed they may have had chariots with blades across the front of them that maybe went out 10 or 12 feet wide, or maybe more. It's like a scissors or, you know, a blade of a knife, just put off across instead of a bumper. And if they could go through an infantry, they could just slice people right off at the knees and kill them with that. Worse than tanks, in a sense. And well, what happened is that when Israel put them to flight with God's help, that it started to rain. And then it got muddy from that brook to make a raging river. And so their chariots started bogging down in the mud as they were trying to get away. And so the Israelites caught up with them and on foot and slayed a lot of them. The king, Sisera, remember, escaped. And he went by somebody's house named Jill. And she says, "Why don't you come in? You look like you're worn out from running." He's running on foot, trying to get away from the Israelites. And so, "Come on in, have a little something to eat or a little rest in her tent." And he says, "Can I have a little water? I'll give you some better. I'll give you some clabbered milk." She gave him a little something. "Now, you put a," he said, "Why, you're awful tired. You must need some sleep." So she put him to sleep, put a blanket over him, and tucked him in. And then he's good sleeping way, snoring pretty well. She went outside and got a stake from her tent, maybe 12 to 15 inches long, you know, metal. And she came up back with a mallet. And she pinned him, not like to do in wrestling. She pinned his head to the floor and got rid of him. And she became a heroine of Israel because she had done that thing. It was a noble thing she did. Sounds bad, but actually it was a good thing. Got rid of this evil king. And but that happened there. You can find that in Judges 4 and 5. It's rather interesting. But you see how God helped him too with the rain, so they could not escape. He did that before, don't you remember, back in Egypt when they're going through the Red Sea? The water started coming in a little bit and filling up that basin there. And a little bit, and here the horses and the chariots couldn't move around. It was kind of like Russia in 1941 for the Germans when it started raining like crazy in the fall, new record rainfall. And so they got stuck in the mud with their tanks, and they couldn't get out. And then it dried up, and it frosted, so they could move again. But then as soon as they did that, then it got down to 60 degrees below zero. Lowest temperatures they had there in 100 years. And so they lost the Battle of Moscow. But it's rather interesting. Elijah had the priest of Baal executed there at Megiddo. Josiah, who was a good king, as you remember, made some mistakes like everybody else does. And one of the things is he meddled in somebody else's war. The Egyptians were coming up from Egypt. They were going through Israel, yes, and coming there by the way of the sea. But they were going up not to fight Israel, but to go keep going north and go up to Assyria and fight the Assyrians. In fact, the Israelites were warned, and Josiah was warned, stay out of this. It's not your war. We're not going to fight you. We're not going to give you any trouble. We just want to get through and get up there and get rid of our enemies there. But Josiah decided to get involved with it. Sounds like Syria, doesn't it? And and meddle with it, and he got killed in the war up there in Megiddo, Josiah, 1 Kings 23. Meddling in other people's wars. Does that sound familiar? Afghanistan, Iraq, Fight an Adam. I don't know. It seems like Israel just seems to want to do that. But it seems like we every time we do, we just make things worse for ourselves in so many ways. In 1799, Napoleon was fighting in Egypt against the British and others, and he had a terrible debacle there of losing a lot of men and a lot of ships were sunk by the British. And then he didn't hear any news from France for a long time, and so he's wondering what's happening up there in my country. He's supposed to be the emperor of France, you know, the first consul at least did back then. And he finally was able to get the news, what was happening, and found out it wasn't very good news, that they were leaderless in France, and they lost the war in Italy. They have nothing but trouble in the country, and it almost looks like it's going to be a counter-revolution against him. So he felt, I have to get back there right away, or I'm going to lose the whole country of France. And so he got on his one or two ships with some of his men. He left General Kleiber in charge and left all his army there in Egypt. Just left them, didn't even tell him he's going. And they were in bad shape, too. They got eye trouble from being in Egypt. About a third of them had eye trouble. And they were disillusioned. They were eating their horses and their mules because they ran out of food. In fact, one time they got 3,000 Turks that they had took prisoner, and they offered them a safe conduct and protection if they'd give up, which they did. And then they found out they had so little food they couldn't even feed their troops, their own troops. So they went down to the coast, Mediterranean, and killed them all, slaughtered all these men. Some were boys with them, too. So that left a bad name for France, too. Well, Kleiber stayed and fought up into what we call Israel today. He went up to Megiddo and, with 3,000 French troops and others, faced 20,000 Turks and defeated them with his cannon. So he fought up there, too, and he prevailed on them. 1 year later, he was assassinated in Egypt. 1918, the Battle of Megiddo, people might know about that, isn't that long ago. At the end of the First World War, General Allenby, well, in 1917, actually in December, he went and conquered and took over Jerusalem, as you remember. He was a little bit more humble than the Kaiser of Germany, who went there in 1898. And wanted to go through one of the gates, but he wanted to go through there on his horse, riding his horse. Well, the gate was too low, so he had them break out part of the gate so he could go through it on his horse. What a arrogant person he was. And then when Allenby came through that same one, he walked with his horse through there. He didn't make them do that. But anyway, Allenby came up there to Megiddo with his troops, with the help of some Arabian irregulars and others, and that were being helped by the council and help of Lawrence of Arabia, as you remember him. They defeated the Turks there in Megiddo. So there's a lot of, there's more that happened. I haven't been able to put it all together. But a lot of things happened in Megiddo, and it has been a place, as you can see, of battles, famous battles. So people have just assumed that that's going to be the place of what they call the final battle. But actually, it's leading up to the final battle. Let's look over here in Revelation, the 16th chapter. Revelation 16. Verse in verse 1, I heard a loud voice from the temple saying to the seven angels, go and pour out the bowls of the wrath of God on the earth. So the first went out with the bowls of wrath and poured out his bowl upon the earth, and a foul and loathsome sore came on a man and beast. Now this is during the day of the Lord, the seven plagues here. And some of them were very like the ones in Egypt that God had performed before with the Egyptians when they would not let Israel go. Remember in Exodus. Second angel pours out his bowl in the sea, and the sea became blood as a dead man, living creatures in the sea died. And it goes through the different plagues that go through in this day of the Lord, the last part of it. And then we go down here to, we won't go through all of the different plagues, but verse 12, the sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates. You know, it's rather interesting. God repeats the same thing at different times for different purposes. You know, he dried up the Red Sea for the Israelites to get out. And then later on, he dried up the Jordan River so the Israelites would go across the Jordan River dry shod. And now, at the end of the age, he dries up the river Euphrates, of all places. You know where the Euphrates is, don't you? In the Tigris rivers? We should be pretty well acquainted with them because they're in Iraq. And our men were over there fighting in Iraq. In fact, that's the old land of where, who was it? Abraham lived over there in that area. And he was told to move, wasn't he? And he did. God had him move away from there. And it was a cradle of civilization. Anyway, this great river is going to be dried up so people can come across it. Okay. And who? What people? Its water was dried up so that the way of the kings from the east might be prepared. Kings of the East. So who would these be? Well, over in that area, you'd find Iraq, you'd find Iran, you'd see find Armenia, you'd find Lower Russia, and the peoples of the Kyrgyz Steppe of Central Asia would be able to come, would be coming that way. North of Iran is, of course, Russia. And they would come down that way and be able to go across dry shod for a purpose. Then verse 13, I saw three unclean spirits like frogs coming out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. So here we see three individuals are focused on. The dragon, which is Satan the devil, is involved. The beast that we read about in Revelation, whose number is 666, the beast of Revelation, the great, probably the great dictator that, or highest one in their government of, in 12 resurrected, or the 10 resurrected nations of the Roman Empire. And out of the mouth of the false prophet, the religious leader of the same group of people. They're all involved in this movement. For they are the spirits of demons performing signs which go out to the kings of the earth of the whole world. So demons are involved here in this whole activity. It's really, really interesting, you know. You know, they think there's a big warfare between God and Satan, and Satan seemed to be winning. Well, when you look at it, actually, demons are now playing into the hands of what God wants to do. It's interesting. You know, they think somehow they can still defeat him, I guess. And it's like somebody's using, manipulating you for a purpose that he has, and you think you're gonna win. And or you want to think you're going to win. I guess you'd put it that way. But it's not going to work. God has the last laugh. Read Psalms 2. if you want to read about the last laugh. God says he will laugh when he sees what they're trying to do, the kings of the earth. And that psalm, too, is so interesting because it does really relate with these last days. So early in history, Psalm 2, for relating with the day of the Lord, actually, when you look at it, in this great battle that's going to be taking place. But you see who's involved in bringing these people down there and having a way to get from the north, from the east, down to south somewhere of the Euphrates River, get across to the south side. And this is the reason: to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty, the great battle of God himself. God is going to be involved with this battle. That's his battle. This is his battle. And they're going right in there like sheep to slaughter, in a sense. They don't even know it. Their leaders don't believe it, don't think so. Why exactly they're doing this, we don't know yet. But they must be deceived into thinking that they're doing something okay and or right for their country or protecting their country or maybe these somebody's down there who we have to defeat, very powerful perhaps, so we have to take a lot of people. Remember, as we see how things work, to tribulation, the day of the, and the heavenly signs in the day of the Lord, and the two woes start the day of the Lord, the attack from the west, from the beast power on the east, and the second woe, they coming back, Russia and countries coming back on them. So both those groups of nations are going to be in pretty bad shape. It's interesting to me that it talks about the men and the horses come down. If this is the end of the age, why would they use horses? Why don't they use tanks? Why don't they use helicopters? Why don't they use attack missiles? Why don't they use all that great technology we have today? That you can shoot something 20 miles away, you don't even see the target, you see it in a little screen someplace, and it knows exactly where to go by laser and all that, and you can't miss. You see a door on some building in Tehran, and you want that bomb to go through that one little door, 6 feet by 3 feet wide, and you want it into that building, that one place, surgical strike, they call it, and it'll do it. Unbelievable. I'll leave the rest of it alone if it's a small enough bomb. But we have fantastic things to be able to do that. Why are they going to go out here with horses? Is that all that John understood in the first century? That's rather interesting. After a great war like this, where they're fighting it out, maybe technologically, like I said, it seemed to me that if they're both worn out, they'd put their products of destruction are destroyed themselves. And all they have left is men and horses and maybe swords. And they're reduced to that. So I think that in context of what happens before this with these great kings of the earth, that they're not going to have anything else to use. But there's going to be a lot of them. You know, there's a safety in numbers, as they say. Not exactly. But let's see what happens here. And then Christ says, I'm coming as a thief. Blessed he who washes, keeps his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame. And that's to us, his people. And then verse 16, and they gathered them together to the place called in Hebrew Armageddon, or Mount Megiddo, or Mount of the governor. Solomon, by the way, did have administrative quarters there at Megiddo during his kingdom. He had a lot of horses there. He had stables there. He had granaries there. And so it was a place that was used for a lot of things. But they are going to be gathered there. Then it's interesting because it stops here. So they're gathered there at Armageddon, or the Mount of Megiddo, Jezreel Valley, sure a lot of room for everybody. You could have millions of people in that valley. By the way, I was looking at this a little bit. It's kind of interesting. In modern terms, in the 1870s, there was a Lebanese family, wealthy family, I guess, and their name was Sergak, the Sergak family, and they lived in Lebanon, part of the Ottoman Empire at that time, of the Turkish Empire. And they went to the Turkish government and they bought 80,000 acres of the Jezreel Valley or plain from the Turkish government in the 1870s for 20,000 pounds. I know what 20 pounds are worth back then. If they were English pounds or if they were Turkish pounds, whatever they were, but 20,000 pounds, whatever it was. And then in the 1912 to 1925, that same family sold to the American Zion Commonwealth that 80,000 acres of land they had there in the Jezreel, the best land of all Israel for growing crops and stuff. They sold it for 750,000 pounds. Pretty good profit from 20,000 to 750,000 pounds. But they sold it to the American Zion Commonwealth. Americans raised money so they could buy this land so Jewish immigrants could come there and settle on it. And from 1912 to 1925, then it became part of the French colonial protectorate for a while at that time. And so a lot of Jewish people who came down from different countries and settled in Israel were given land to work and have farms on. You know how one thing leads to another. They had so much good land there, and they needed a lot of help. They didn't have a whole lot of Jewish people went there that early. And so they needed laborers. And then, so the people who lived around in a Jordan area or east, mostly Muslims and others, Arabs and others, they heard there was work over there in those farms. And so they gravitated over there, they immigrated there to those Jewish farms and started working them in Israel, where we call Israel today. They grew fast because they had a lot of big families. And before long, there were more of those people, the Palestinians we might call them today, than there were Jews there. And so they came in as a result of Jewish immigration, most of them. Before that, there weren't too many of anybody living there, before the 1880s, in fact. Mark Twain went through there. He says, I went for days and didn't see anybody. A couple of Druids, a couple of Bedouins in their tents, and that's all. So who would want this land, he said. It was lousy, most of it. But the Jezreel Valley is beautiful, and it has it looks like part of America. In fact, if you went over, you think it's all desert over there? It isn't. It really isn't. To the north part of Israel, Galilee area, there's some beautiful, beautiful farmland, just like in the United States. But anyway, these people bought that land, and then they really helped the Lebanese, actually helped the Jewish get started over there and made some money at it, too. Lebanese are pretty good at that. Anyway, that's where it stops. They're gathered, it says, and then it stops. Doesn't talk about any fight, doesn't talk about battle or anything like that. They're gathered. And then what happens? Well, Joel, in other places, as Mr. Hafey is alluding to it in places this morning, does give you the answer. In fact, he did quote Joel here, Joel 3, but I want to go a little further. And he says in Joel, the third chapter in verse 1, behold, in those days, and at that time I will bring back the captives of Judah and Jerusalem, and I will gather all nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. The Jehoshaphat, as he mentioned, is a Kidron Valley, which is east of Jerusalem. It's a valley that goes down, and it's between the east side of the Temple Mount, the wall of the temple, and then it goes downhill, and then it goes up to the east again to the Mount of Olives, where Christ left, you know, before he went to back to God. He went up in the heavens, into the clouds. And he's going to come back in the same way. He says his feet are going to be planted on the Mount of Olives, just exactly like he told them would happen, or the angels did, told the troops there, the disciples. But today, if you go there, you'll see it's a big park. There's a highway drives and goes down in it. This valley of the Kidron Valley, to Jehoshaphat. And there's olive trees all over. Mount of Olives is true to form. There are olive trees there. You can get olives off them. And I've been there. And there, right east of the wall of the Temple Mount is a Muslim cemetery. Not very well kept, when I saw it anyway, and some pictures I've seen. Some of those gravestones are just scattered here and there, willy-nilly. And then you go to the east and go up to the Mount of Olives, and there's a Jewish cemetery there that has been largely desecrated by Muslims and others who used some of those grave stones with people's names on them and so forth and took them, showing disrespect, using them for stones around our houses for paving. But that's the way it is today. But that valley is where they're going to be going. And they're going to be coming down. It's easy to get down there from Megiddo, from the Jezreel Valley. Like I said, there's three main ways anciently, and you can traverse those very easily with horses and men. They even have highways there today. Whether the highways will still be extend there and blown up or destroyed or something, I don't know. But they could either way make it down three different ways. Now, the different countries are involved, including the beast and the false prophet, then you know that Europe is involved too, because they're the leaders from that area, the West. So not only the guys from the East coming over the Euphrates River, but others will come from the West, from Europe, whatever's left of their armies there after the battles. And they can come by the Mediterranean Ocean or the sea. They can land there at Haifa or Acre, and come that way through that pass to Megiddo and gather there. And they can come from the central way down from Iraq and so forth, and then the east ones can come, like I mentioned before, to the Megiddo, and they can decide to come down three different ways to Jerusalem. So even if there's a lot of people, there's three ways to travel. Different armies. They can get a lot of people down there. Now, it's rather interesting that when they get there, what happens? Verse 9, this is a battle of God. And so if you don't believe that, if you think it's not God that's involved, you may come down and fight. Now, if you knew it was really God calling you down there to fight, I'm sure you don't want to go. They'd have to force you to go, right? So they must believe that whoever's down there is not God or Allah or whatever. They must believe that he is Antichrist or something like that. He's an enemy of civilization, enemy of the church, enemy of good people everywhere. People will be deceived in doing this. But God is going to invite them down. Now, he doesn't hate the people coming down to fight, but he's going to stop all opposition to the kingdom of God. And this will be the way to do it. When a nation loses its power, its armies, it's prostrate. It has to follow whatever orders are given to it by the occupying powers. Second World War, Germany was like that, remember? Four powers went in and took over the country, and they had to follow all the rules that the occupying powers had imposed on the populace. And because they had no power to resist any longer with their armies. And that's exactly what God's going to do. Yes, there will be people left of those nations. In fact, let's talk about this. People that are left of the nations will come and keep the Feast of Tabernacles in Jerusalem. Left of the people. That means there's probably not too many people left, you know, when he talks that way. And it talks another place, like a remnant of Israel. What's a remnant? You ever have your house carpeted? What's the remnants? Very small part of the carpet, because they don't want to waste carpet, do they? You might buy, 20 yards of carpet, and they only have, two yards left, remnant. That's the way with people, too. You don't have too many people when you just have a remnant of them. You don't have a majority. You have a tiny minority. And as Mr. Hafley was bringing out this morning, a remnant of Israel, were like 10%. Even it might only be 3%. You think about it, because one-third of the people are going to go into captivity of the original population, it says. One-third are going to die from the war and the sword. One-third are going to die from pestilences and disease and starvation and that sort of thing. And one-third will go into captivity. Okay. If 10% of the whole population comes back, that means that one-third of the captivity will survive. Doesn't that mean that? 33%, one-third of 30%, about 11%. One-third of those who are in captivity by the beast power in Europe and other countries are going to survive? Well, I hope so. But maybe it'd be far less. Maybe only 10% of them. And that'll be close to about 3%. So there might be less Israelites that come out of this than 50 million or 60 million. It might be like 10 to 20 million at the most. But the other countries are not going to do very well either with all these things happening, these plagues and everything else, earthquakes and all that, and this last war between these superpowers. But anyway, let's turn over here to 9, verse 9. Proclaim this among the nations, the Golem, or Goyim, as the Jews would call them. Prepare for war. Wake up the mighty men. Let all the men of war draw close. Let them come up. Beat their plowshares into swords. This is exactly opposite of what it says there in Isaiah, where it tells that we are going to be turning our swords into plowshares. Just opposite, isn't it? That's going to happen later. That's going to happen in the world tomorrow when Christ sets up his kingdom. So there won't be any war anymore. Well, there'll be a few wars, but they're not going to be consequential. There's going to be an initial, in a while, there's going to be another, rebellion among the nations of Asia, principally, and they're not going to be able to prevail, as it shows. But beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Now, if this is literal, these are literal swords and literal spears, not tanks and, missiles. I'm not saying it's literal, but so far plowshares sounds pretty literal. They still use them, don't they? You still use plowshares, by the way, in the farms. They might have a John Deere air-conditioned thing pulling it with a stereo and all the comforts at home and a nice easy chair, and you go to sleep and let all the technology turn the thing at every roll by technology, but you still have plowshares digging through the earth and loosening it up for cultivation. Anyway, let the weak say, I am strong. Assemble and come, all you nations, and gather together all around. And that's what they'll do at Megiddo. They will assemble, they will organize, they will figure out how to get things done, who to go where and when. And it's rather interesting when you look at it, you see what's going to happen to them. And it's not hard to imagine, figure at all. When you look at when you put different nations together to fight together, allies, they usually don't get along. Ask General Eisenhower, Second World War. He had nothing but a fight to keep the Allies basically together. The British General Montgomery hated Patton's guts. Patton felt the same way. They both didn't like Eisenhower because he's an incompetent office worker, pencil pusher, as far as they're concerned. He wasn't a battle-tested general. No, he wasn't, but he did a great job of organizing and strategic things and getting the place things where they needed to be and got people in there that could do that kind of work. He was a genius in that way. No, he wasn't a battlefield, no. But they all had their talents to bring to the table. But they didn't get along. In fact, Hitler thought for sure they're going to break up many, many times. That was his hope because they didn't get along at all. But somehow they finished together. The French were despised by the English. Americans didn't like the French either, especially de Gaulle. He was nothing but a thorn in their side. And they'd want to get rid of him so badly because he was that way. He's always complaining and didn't get this and didn't get that, like a baby. Now, any Frenchmen here? Remember, we're Christians. Anyway, the French are really funny people. They're we love them, we hate them. I mean, that's kind of a deal, it is. And both at the same time sometimes. Assemble and come all you nations and gather they all around. But what they're going to do when they get together, they start out already they don't trust each other. Just think about if you're a German soldier or you're a French soldier or you're an Austrian soldier, you just got done fighting with the Russian soldier and the Polish soldier and Czechoslovakian soldier and the Hungarian soldier, perhaps. And it's a gigantic battle, the two woes. And now suddenly you're friends again, you're allies to fight this enemy down there in Jerusalem. They're still not going to trust each other after that terrible war. They're going to have some real baggage mentally about fighting with this Frenchman or this Russian or this German, right? Animosity is still there. And when they get down there, they're not going to be the best of friends. God knows that. He uses that in this battle too. He uses psychology. It's rather interesting. Cause your mighty ones to go down there, O God. So they had to go down from wherever they were. Now, I can't prove anything absolutely with that, but they have to go down, like going down south. And that's where they go. If they go from Armageddon or Megiddo down to Jerusalem, it's going south. Come on down. Like the guy said in the show, you know, that they make $20,000 on, whatever's the name of it. Anyway. And then we go to Zechariah 12 and verse 3. Zechariah 12, verse 3. And it shall happen in that day. A lot of times it uses that term for the day of the Lord. In that day, that I will make Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all peoples. Notice these are all the kingdoms of the earth are sending their armies. So when it says about all peoples, there is a relationship here. All who would heave away will surely be cut to pieces. Heave it away. Though all nations of the earth are gathered against it. Talking about Jerusalem. All nations of the earth are gathered against it. That has never happened before in history. Not all nations of the earth have been gathered down to go against Jerusalem. This is the first time in history this will have been done on the day of the Lord. Yeah, there have been different nations against Jerusalem. Assyrians, Egyptians, name them, Rome, but not all the nations of the earth. This is something unique in history, God's battle. In that day, the Lord says, I will strike every horse with confusion. Interesting. They're going to come down with their horses, but the horses are going to be confused. They don't know where to go. They're scared, afraid, perhaps. I don't know, but they're going to be confused. And it's rider with madness. And they're going to go crazy down there, all fighting together from these different countries. And then they're going to go absolutely nuts and crazy. And God's going to cause it. I will open their eyes on the house of Judah and will strike every horse of the peoples with blindness. So not only they're going to be confused, all right, they're going to go blind right there in the battle, these horses of these people riding down there fighting. And they're going to go crazy. What's happening here? What happened to my horse? Why did it just throw me into this German's belly? Over here in Zechariah 14, behold, the day of the Lord is coming, and your spoil will be divided in your midst, and I will gather all the nations to battle against Jerusalem. The city will be taken, houses rifled, and so forth. But the remnant of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against these nations as he fights in the day of battle. And then it says, in that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives. That's Christ. Verse 12. And this shall be the plague which the Lord will strike all the peoples who fought against Jerusalem. So this shows another way God's going to fight against them. He's going to cause the horses to go blind and be confused. He's going to cause them to go mad or crazy, lunatic, these soldiers packed together in that valley, jostling against each other and starting to think, that guy's trying to kill me. Oh, he's trying to kill me. What's the matter with you guys? You got your swords out, you're going to kill me? I'll kill you. And so they'll start killing each other off, is what they're going to be doing. And it says, verse 12, their flesh shall dissolve while they stand on their feet. Their eyes shall dissolve in their sockets. I know it's not a pretty picture. And their tongue shall dissolve in their mouth. So God will cause some other things to happen to the soldiers besides the wounds from the swords of their fellow soldiers and so forth. Then it says in Revelation 14, verse 20, and something for people hard to imagine this, but it says, the blood will be up to the horses' bridles. You probably heard that one. How's that happen? Well, in the Valley of Kidron or Jehoshaphat, if you look at it, if you have millions of people come down there and fight, and they're so horses, and they start killing each other off, the blood's going to flow. And that valley is going to fill to a certain height of people's bodies. Where is the blood going to go? I mean, it's just like if you took some water, or you took a chicken, you killed 10 chickens, and the blood from the chickens is in the chickens are in the blood is in a bowl, and the blood falls out of the chickens, and then the chickens fill up the bowl, don't they? Well, the blood will tend to come up wherever it can find a place, right? Like water, so you'll have like a sauce to some degree of blood. It's like if you're cooking something and because the bodies take up so much space, and so the blood will have to go someplace and it'll go up. So it doesn't mean that it's going to be solid blood to horses' bridles, but it'll become that height because of all the bodies in there when you think about it. Very, very natural thing. If you got enough bodies, you don't have enough room. And that's what that valley is like. Now, it does go down into the Valley of Hinnom, which is kind of interesting because that's where they burned bodies, down the south end. And there's a park down there, too. If you want to go there today, it's a beautiful park down there in Hill, Park and Hill. But you won't want to park there later. That's not a good place to park, Valley of Hinnom, Gehenna, in Jerusalem. Mr. Hafley brought out about 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 16. It says in Revelation 16, verse 17, it is done. When God gets together these people and then has this battle, he said, it is done. Now, there's certain things that will be done after that. It'll be like an earthquake. Hailstones will fall down. It's going to be a great calamity. Jerusalem's going to be changed. The topography of the whole area is going to be changed. For instance, where the Temple Mount is today, it says it's going to be where God's place is, the temple is going to be, is the highest place. It isn't today. Mount Scopus to the north is higher in elevation. Not much, but it's higher in elevation than where the temple is today, or where the temple area is. The Muslim Sikkut, or what do you call it? Dome of the Rock. But that time, it's going to be raised, or the other parts of the land around are going to be lowered. And also the Mount of Olives is going to be changed. You know, you're going to have a stream going out from Jerusalem to the east, to the Dead Sea. All kinds of things are going to happen there. And it's going to be a fantastic difference. But the beautiful thing is that we say that opposition to God is stopped. And now God's government will have a free hand in going out and showing these people God's way from Jerusalem. And as we read there in about the Feast of Tabernacles, the rest of the people come to, or the representatives of the people come to Jerusalem for the feast. And they see what's happening down there. They see people are happy. They'll see people are doing well. They're healthy. They have jobs. They enjoy each other's company. They get along well because they've learned to follow God's way of life, the Ten Commandments. And Christ is their king. And when they see the results, the blessings, the good things that are coming, these people are well-fed, got nice homes, and they're responsible citizens, and they're people you like to be around, frankly. They'll say, boy, why don't we have this back up there in Russia? Why don't we have it up there in Germany and in France and all these other places? And we'll tell them why. Because of sin, because of Satan, who's now been removed, and how they can have a wonderful life too if they repent and turn to God and are taught and willing to listen to follow God's way. I don't think it's going to take them very long to respond at all. You know, the fastest way to get somebody to respond, it's not a permanent way, but it's an initial way, and that's physically. You know, give somebody something to eat. Somebody needs a place to stay, give them a place to stay. You show a little love, a little kindness, and then you teach them things that are helpful to them and good for them, and they see they're working and they're happy, and God gives them his spirit so they can understand it. And boy, you're on the ball. You're on the way. And that's what God is doing with us. He wants us to learn to follow his way so we can teach others to be successful also forever. So let's be about our Father's business.